those of you who have long presumed that some contemporary music is the product of composers with disturbed minds who maintain hidden agendas, your suspicions may at last have been vindicated.
Yes! 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 I'm so glad you said that. Please continue. I want to hear more. Vindicate me!
Last month in Venice, Italy, and coincidentally also in Venice, California, police broke up an avant-garde dinner theater performance of Olio Nation by Otto Kandinsky, in which the central theme of cannibalism played an all-too-realistic role. Advertising for the production stressed a unique opportunity for audience participation. However, by the time the constabulary arrived, no audience members, save for a few scalps and a pile of sodden underwear, were left to question, their participation having become fundamental to the performance. Like that. Behind the production, it was later learned, was a gang of carnivorous musical thugs with ties to ASCAP, BMI, the Aaron Copland Foundation, Kiraly Music Network, the Omaha Operetta Society, and dozens of other internationally known musical organizations. Following a bloody trail of spectator scrapple, authorities gradually uncovered a twisted plot to rid the world of unappreciative audiences by turning them into kippered cadavers. While many violists, piano tuners, finale programmers, and backup singers publicly criticized the flesh-eating schemes of their more barbaric musical cousins, many others, even peripherally affiliated with the world of music, silently applauded their predacious actions. Too long, they reasoned, had their fates rested in the hands, as it were, of audience steeped in the manner of fickleness. For too long had the ignoranti dictated what appealed to them, instead of being open to new ideas from experimentalists.
Ignoranti.
See.
That must be someone I know. Yes.
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 To turn some of these unenlightened individuals into goulash, wieners, and fricassee, the phrase jerky comes to mind, seemed perfectly rational, not to mention an inexpensive way to stretch the food budget. Alas, the authorities were not so perspicacious, and they promptly rang down the curtain on the Toonsmith Trencherman's patron to pemmican operations, even going so far as to temporarily banish performances of operatic food fight scenes until the sources of the hurled comestibles could be verified by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Ironically, Kandinsky's Olio Nation was, with a couple of minor modifications, such as the substitution of corned Willy wood chips for theater-goer Salman Gundi, permitted to continue its run of audience participation performances. Journalistic hyperbole in the local news media helped to fuel huge and enthusiastic crowds starved for outlandish entertainment, and a perverse symbiotic relationship was born. Born of perversity is what many have called, although few have chosen, the previous 119 episodes of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, this 120th episodic milestone of which is certain to be no less distorted, though perhaps with fewer unintentional allusions to Le Flambeau Orient.
Le Flambeau Orient.
Ouch. Than the others. Just because the bulk of tunes we've inflicted on unwary ears during the past 27 and a half months has stared cannibalism and similar avenues of controversial creativity squarely in the one good eye and said, "Good job!" is no reason to end the sentence in the pluperfect, assuming that our musical offspring will pick up the gastronomic pieces, dump them into a big ovarian pot, and cook up a bilious batch of electroacoustical tone row souffle, the tasty antecedent of which follows immediately in an LP format, thanks in no minute part to Calvus.
Good job.
Good job indeed, and I believe we have more good job today.
We do indeed. It's the difficult listening episode of the Calvos and Damien and New Music Bazaar. Gosh, that was a wonderful introduction. I just got the regular old willies.
I didn't even know it was to be that difficult of a musical day, not with Amy Beach's name staring us in the kisser.
True enough, the birthday of Amy Beach, but we're skipping that one today, and we're going right on to the birthday of John Cage, to whose Variations 2 for piano you are currently listening with David Tudor on the keyboard and such.
This was an LP, you may
yes.
recall, that was
yes.
opened on the air last
oh,
year.
Oh, that's the one that was opened on... Well, wonderful. It's now a year old.
Yeah, we opened it to play Milton Babbitt's ensembles for synthesizer.
And instead got... whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
Oh, well, they don't
whoosh,
maintain their...
whoosh.
Viability.
Unlike CDs that just go... You're trying to say... just it's like that.
Like
that. Let's listen to the rest of Variations 2 for piano, or some of the rest, and then we'll continue with a little celebration of John Cage, the difficult listening show, and at 3 o'clock, an interview with Christopher...
What? Just a little time phase
little
differential.
Time phase differential. An interview with Christopher K. Konigsberg. So, okay, for the moment, and here's John Cage.
it in the first 5 days of the fall, in the warm daylight. Robins, bluebirds, in families on the almost bare elms, babies, and probably purple finches. Now the year is that
Yeah.
Little John Cage.
Not so difficult listening, really.
Not at all, no.
No, especially in that particular combination. We started off with the Variations 2 with David Tudor on piano and moved into the... what was that we moved into? Oh, the second construction for four percussionists played by the Cremata Percussion Ensemble. We've heard them before playing some wonderful music by... What's that that we heard them play before? Oh, yeah, Yoshihasa Taira. We heard them play that wonderful piece called Hierophany 5. And then mixed with that was two of the Solo for Voice series, Solo for Voice 49 and Solo for Voice 52, with the absolutely lovely voice of Joan LaBarbera on that particular combination. And then finally, wrapping around Solo for Voice 52 was the Suite for Toy Piano. Again, a just charming thing called, from a wonderful CD called In a Landscape. That was with Stephen Drury on the toy piano.
And the two pieces merged together so well.
Actually, they did. It was just, it was almost as if they were written together. That was very nice. Well, all right, let's really get into the a little bit more difficult listening.
Now, this is difficult listening for people who are not used to difficult listening difficult pieces.
Right.
Otherwise, people who are used to this sort of music will not find it difficult, just entertaining.
Especially if they've perhaps played it.
Yes.
This would be a great piece to play. We're going to listen to some Kaija Saariaho. By the way, the reason we're using the term difficult listening is there's a show, and I believe it's in Australia, on RTQE radio called Difficult Listening. And so we've just sort of swiped their name for today's show to go along with our interview with Christopher K. Konigsberg.
Who was a difficult subject himself.
Yes, a difficult subject. And his music is probably, well, it certainly already on the show has garnered the most take-it-off phone calls, and not referring to his habitement, but his music. So let's listen to a little bit of Kaija Saariaho. This is the opening. We'll listen to some Paul Reuters following that, so we'll have a kind of a juncture of the two in the middle in the next 10 minutes.
Juncture is a kind word.
Yes, right. Verblendungen for orchestra and tape. This is a piece from 1982 to 84 in this particular performance with the YLE Experimental Studio Tape and the Avanti Chamber Orchestra. Wonderful, wonderful performance. At least we like it.
Oh, we do, we do.
Let's get difficult, down and difficult.
Yes, yes. Some disturbing music for those of you who cater to such things. We started with Kayasarayaho's for blending, and part of it anyway, the first part for orchestra and tape, conducted by Yuka Pekka Sarasate, one of those guys, and the Avanti Chamber Orchestra, followed by the conclusion to the first movement of the symphony of Paul Ruders, conducted by Leif Segerstam and the Danish National Radio Symphony Orchestra.
Nice long name for a little country orchestra.
Right, but they certainly know how to play big musical notes.
They do, fat notes.
And I think the last piece in particular, Mr. Ruders' piece, I certainly had the image of someone walking out into the fields and stomping on field mice without hesitation. Just
Danish field mice?
Danish, yes, any kind of.
And they put them in little pastries and serve them for breakfast?
They do. Ah.
Goes along with that piece you were talking about at the beginning of the show in the essay.
The cannibalistic piece. Oh, yes. Yes, I have to refer back to the piece, Oleo Nation,
right. Speaking of which, I was watching Alien 3 with Sigourney Weaver last night, speaking of alien things and Olean things. It's the Calvus and Damian New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield. We're about to begin our interview with Chris Konigsberg. But I thought before we actually did that, there's one point at which he talks about his piece, Rat's Nest. And in listening back to the discussion about that, it wasn't entirely clear how he came about producing that. And so what I've done today is bring in a little portable computer and use the simple procedure of taking any arbitrary file and playing it. As computer data and the sound data are essentially indistinguishable, except by some element in the file that says, I am sound, I am a word processing document, I am a program. You know, there's no real distinction one from the other. So if I were to play a sound file, normally it would be no trouble and it would come back and you would think, oh, I'm listening to a recording, when in fact you're listening to a stream of digital information. It's simply possible to play back any old piece of digital information. And so I've got this little machine here, and it's, with any luck, it's all hooked up here in front of me, and we should be able to play something from it. So what I've set aside here is a little program that claims it can play anything. And I kind of looked at it in advance and thought, well, let me play a couple of things and see what I've got. So right now I'm going to try and play itself. have the program play its own self. It'll only be a few seconds long, but you'll get an idea of a stream of digital data. And there's the program itself, playing itself. That's a stream of digital data made up of the bytes that are actually running the program. So I thought, all right, well, why not play something else? And I thought, well, let me choose something longer, something musical.
By whose definition, musical? Your definition or is this definition?
You are absolutely correct. By my definition on this difficult listening program,
yes,
of course.
Indeed.
So I figured, well, what better program to play than my email program?
Yeah.
It seems to be about the right length, and it has lots of little lilting melodies in it.
Little fiddly bits?
Little fiddly bits. So here's a brief performance by the I'll Play Any Stream of Data You Throw at Me program, playing Eudora. Here it is. And so...
a theme and variation.
Absolutely. So that's the principle by which Chris Konigsberg created Rat's Nest. And he'll explain where he got the information and how. But I thought maybe, just because it seemed a little unclear in the interview itself what was going on, there's an example. So the computer's actually playing back an arbitrary stream of information. And that can be anything. It can be a real sound file, which is something turned into digital data by a conversion process, or it can be something made to seem to the program to be a sound file.
This will only encourage those people who are looking forward to some difficult listening.
Absolutely. So shall we go to the burbs?
I'm certainly ready.
All right.
Right away, that's probably louder than I'll be talking, and then I happen to mumble and talk.
Get
quiet.
Oh, yeah.
Mumble.
That's good.
Somewhere in between.
Wonderful.
Okay.
This is a live test.
Yeah.
We're in the burbs.
Yeah.
The Princeton burbs of New Jersey. It's incredible. This entire block of flats and homes has been purchased by Amway, and we're in the very center of the Amway distributorship, sitting in a home that I think has been furnished by all sorts of exotic distributors.
Walmart.
Walmart. And Floor Mart. And Nobody Ceiling Mart. Yes.
But watch out. We just got a beautiful bright orange printed notice in our mailbox the other day from our neighbors that he's starting a Bible study group, and we're invited to come over.
Very
and
good.
And you're already,
one
huh?
of the seven virtues Dwarfs. In something or other, chapter this and that or something.
The seven deadly virtues. I remember those. That was isn't that a piece by Kurt Weill?
Something
like that. We are, in fact, in the burbs. We are in the burbs with a dangerous composer.
So I've heard. You yes. experienced this firsthand, so please tell
yes.
the story.
Well, first of all, tell the name is for any of those people who'd like to call
and
in
who
and
we
abuse
are.
Him right now. Yes, here on the Galvos. Yes, Calvos and Damien, New Music Bazaar, our guest is. And you must pronounce it because I want to hear how you say your last name, because we've been saying Chris Konigsberg all week.
Well, I generally say Chris Konigsberg. When I write my name down, I like to say Christopher K. Konigsberg in full, but when I say it, I like to say Chris, because I used to get different ID cards and credit cards, and some of them would be Chris Konigsberg, and some would be Christopher Konigsberg, and some would be Christopher K. Konigsberg, and some would be Chris K. Konigsberg, and some would be C.K. Konigsberg.
But we were okay with
how
the Chris
shop
part.
Yeah. Well, and the last name, actually my mother pronounces it Konigsberg, but she's Italian, so that doesn't really count. And my father got remarried. They got divorced, and my father got remarried.
And he changed his
15
name?
Years ago, and he's changed his name now to Konig.
Oh, Konig.
He dropped his Berg off the end, so I was thinking of changing my name to Zberg.
Or just Chris the K would work well in,
yeah.
in the, your medium.
I use my initials a lot, to CKK.
CKK at POBox.com.
Right, it's my email address, my portable email address.
Portable.
Meanwhile, back to the story.
Back to the story. Well, you know, we have been on the air for coming up 2 years with our show. And last week we played some of the new releases we received from people. I got a huge pile of them in the mail on Saturday and dragged them all with me to the radio station. I said, we're going on this tour, we're talking to some of these composers, and here are some samples. And I had sampled some before the show, and I said, I'll play Rat's Nest. Well, we got three, count them, three calls from listeners who said, take that off.
We had one listener
who actually said, what right do you have to play that?
That's wonderful. I used to be a DJ on the air on the Carnegie Mellon radio station, WRCT FM 88.3 in Pittsburgh, PA, which is a great freeform college radio station. I was actually on the air for 10 years because I took a long time to graduate. And I hung around and worked there for a long time afterwards. But we used to count hate calls, and we used to try to get more hate calls than the other guy. And
well, we really don't try, you know, and this was just...
I did a show once where I played alternating heavy metal and classical music because the general manager at a staff meeting had given an example of the worst possible thing you could possibly do would be to play heavy metal music right after a classical piece. So I did a whole show of alternating heavy metal and classical and we would get lots of hate calls. I had one guy who was always begging me to play Led Zeppelin, and I would say, okay, I'll put on some Led Zeppelin next, right after this. And then I would just put on some sort of random noise garbage, and I'd string him along for hours, and every week the guy would call back. I mean, he was a devoted listener, even though I never played what he wanted. It was almost as if he was a masochist and wanted
to torture. Well, I was just going to add, are you the official sonic sadist? Is this a new technique?
Well, I mean, I sort of like to say that I'm a fish out of water in a way now, because when I grew up or when I acquired some of these tastes, I had buddies and friends and whatnot, people to share some of this with, you know, and now I'm just on my own, and people are staring at me saying, what kind of a lunatic are you? And I sort of turn around and say, well, what do you think, guys? And there's nobody there to back me up anymore, you know. But at WRCT, we had a whole raft of DJs, and there was something called systems research, where they would play just random tapes of noise and try to get hate calls, and they would record the hate calls and put them on the air and mix them in with the noise. So someone would be calling up saying, what is this? What is this? Take this off. And they'd be on the air mixed in with the thing that they were complaining about. And that wasn't even my idea. That was John Fetkovich, who we called Fetko, Fetch affectionately. And I had a freeform acoustic improvisation group called the Morphic Resonance Trio, where I played acoustic bass, and another guy played bassoon, and another guy played saxophone. In fact, we were all three DJs at WRCT. That's how we met in 1984. And we would do concerts at people's houses, at parties sometimes. And one time, there was a party, and somebody in the kitchen started banging on a pot with a spoon. And I think I joined in and started banging on another pot. And the whole room started picking up pots and pans and banging on them with spoons and whatnot. And the whole house of like 30 or 40 people all were picking up pots and pans and banging on them with spoons and stuff. And people were going nuts. And this, like the one guy who was the, I don't know, he was the business manager of the radio station, and he went on to get a job as a top 40 radio executive, you know, marketing commercial stuff. He was really drunk, I guess, and he was like slamming his body into a counter, you know, in rhythm and everything, and this whole thing was going on, and unfortunately they destroyed all the pots and pans in the house. It was just a mess afterwards. And then
I'll speak about the silverware.
Well, and then those roommates came home, and they were a bunch of football playing jocks, and they were really upset at what had happened. So at the next staff meeting of this radio station, we took up a collection to replace the pots and pans. It was my idea to take up the collection, and we actually replaced the pots and pans, especially this folding omelet pan that was precious possession. So I kept the broken pots and pans, and we called it the Fetko Memorial Kitchen Orchestra. And for the next few concerts after that, when the Morphic Resonance Trio would play, we would hand out the pots and pans to the audience from the Fetko Memorial Kitchen Orchestra. So that's the relationship of omelet pans to the rat's nest.
So is this a new character? Well, the CD, by the way, is called Brains. It's a wonderful CD, and you call it audiophile computer music.
Yes, I like to provoke interesting philosophical and aesthetic discussions. I like to think too much and talk too much, and there's a time for playing and making noise. There's a time for making beautiful things, or time for making horrendous things and pissing everybody off. But there's also a time to sit and think and evaluate and discuss things. And if you use certain kinds of words, they have associations and connotations, and they bring up certain kinds of discussions. And I was hoping that somebody would understand what I was trying to say by calling it audiophile computer music. And the person who seemed to understand the most was the reviewer for Fanfare magazine, which is it's quote, the magazine for serious classical record collectors. And the reviewer said some wonderful stuff based on the notion that if somebody claims to be audiophile, they're immediately bringing up all these connotations and challenging you, and it brings up notions of people who hand-pick the copper strands for their speaker wires and whatnot, you know. And then, he said, and then you go to this music and you have this piece, The Rat's Nest, which seems like such incredible noise that in one sense you would think it's the opposite of what an audiophile would be looking for. But on the other sense, on the other hand, the noise is so finely detailed and so intricate and so immaculately complex that it really is a perfect encapsulation of that idea. So I was really happy that this reviewer got the point of that.
I think we should dive right in and play that as the starting tune, as it were, of yours. And it's interesting how you created that piece. We all have different ways of finding our source material, and this is probably one of the most interesting ones I've ever heard.
There's the long story or the short story. I guess I'll give you the short story. I had been doing a philosophical investigation in the notion of ownership and authorship. And I used to say that I was not a composer because I didn't start with an idea in my head and painfully wrench it out onto paper and revise it and work on it till it was perfect and then hand it off to musicians to interpret, like the way Beethoven had done. And I wanted to reserve the word composer for someone who followed that process. I have a long background in improvisation and in jazz and in playing classical music and playing in rock bands and whatnot, and sculpting pieces in electronic studios and in computer music studios, but I've never really sat down and composed a work like that. So I wanted to explore this notion of how far can you go before you have to give up the notion of authorship. And I was interested in some historical precedents like Marcel Duchamp's pieces, where he took an existing masterpiece painting, the Mona Lisa, and all he did was add a mustache to that, and then he appropriated it as his own work. Or he went and he found what he called ready-mades. He found a urinal in a garbage dump and brought it into a gallery and put it up on a stand and said that this was a sculpture. So I wanted to explore that notion, but my feeling was that aesthetically I couldn't really justify something that simple. I really wanted to think of the idea of value added, of how much could I add to the original source material.
Value added music.
Right. So
no wonder why we were talking about Walmart before.
Yes. The artist, I mean, often a notion of an artist is someone who conceives an idea from the very beginning and then brings it into life through all of its trials and tribulations. But there are other notions of an artist who manipulates things that already exist. And then there's this question of sampling. There was the controversy when MC Hammer appropriated the bass line of Rick James' song Super Freak and made a new song out of it, a new hit single. But really the hook in it was Rick James's. And people said, well, why should I say that's MC Hammer's song when it's really the essence of it is Rick James? So I wanted to explore this notion of where do you draw the line between the previous essence and the new essence if you add something. And in computer music, with computer studio techniques, you can often manipulate something so much as to make it completely unrecognizable. So it almost doesn't matter what source you start with. You could put in something arbitrary and random, anything at all, and come out with something totally different. And there are certain classes of effects that I call artifacts of the analysis that come out no matter what the input thing is. So there was another series of pieces that I worked on called the Basement Artifact series. But then meanwhile, I wanted to go even farther and take completely random input. I wanted to find garbage, so to speak. And they say you can't, I don't know if I can use this word, but you can't polish an animal's leftover waste, let's say.
It's a bit of spore.
Yes, so, but there are people who spend their life studying spores and who find some kind of beautiful, systematic complexity in the study of spores, I'm sure.
Following the scat.
Yeah, right, and that's where scat singing came from. So I searched around for what I call digital garbage that I would appropriate, and I tried various kinds of files, computer files, interpreting them as audio. And the point is that a sound file on the computer, it's just pretty much random data, but you have a sound file header which tells you how to interpret it. So I could take an arbitrary data file and add one of these sound file headers, and all of a sudden you've got a sound file, even though it was never actually sound in the real world that was recorded or something.
And there's a utility that is available as freeware called Will Play Anything. And it will take a file and copy it into a new file and put a sound header on it and then play it for you.
Okay. So I'm familiar with a few different versions of that kind of thing.
Right.
There's Sound Hack, the Macintosh, or Sox is another one. So I spent a few weeks exploring and trying the Mac Finder and the VM Unix kernel of Unix systems and whatnot. And I found that one of the most interesting bits to start with was in the Next operating system, the Next Step system, that it had a sort of a bug where it allocated virtual memory and kept allocating more and more and more and never really deallocated, never really returned it. So you would run a Next Step computer for a few days and eventually the swap partition would fill up and you would have to reboot. So I started collecting those swap files. And the interesting thing is that it's not just totally random stuff. Some of it comes from the space being used by a program. So if you've got a drawing program and you're drawing a picture, the bits that make up that picture are stored in the swap space.
Right.
So if there's a certain kind of a pattern to them, it may show up when you interpret it as audio. So I collected a lot of these and worked with them. And I was getting some really awesome, incredible sounds because there are sharp transitions from loud to soft or high to low or something that are just impossible for any sort of living creature to produce. And yet they sound like gestures. They sound like superhuman gestures. And we have this tendency to look for patterns, whether they're there or not. We have our minds, our cognitive processes just want to search for patterns. So you will look in the darkness and you will see things in the darkness, right? You don't really have a... John Cage even found it was not possible to have true silence because you always have two sounds inside your ears. The one of them is your blood pressure and the other one is your nervous system. So I started getting some really amazing, beautiful sounds out of these swap files. Now, they're mostly pretty harsh and sort of violent in nature. So I wanted to work on them and make some more gentle things and contour a real piece. And again, this is this idea of the value-added business, that a composition has an overall shape and structure that is clearly the work of a human being thinking and lovingly kneading the clay or whatever, even if it started off as just some clay, say some muck that you picked up off the riverbank. So that's pretty much what I did with that. There are two halves to the piece, the rat's nest, and the first half is very extensively shaped and massaged in such a way that they're very, very delicate, really, really wonderful things, if I may say so myself. And you can listen for these really quiet things, and then it may get loud for a while, but then get quiet again. And they're just some things that sound like a gesture, but they're like impossible gestures. And then it leads into the second half, which is pretty much cranked wide open more like the original sound file. But even that, I shape it so it builds up. It has a dramatic curve to it. When I played it for my composition professor, Alvin Curran at Mills College, he said, oh, it's not random enough. You know, there should be stuck notes and things, you know. So I went back looking through the swap files, and I found one place where there was a sort of a steady note for, like, 2 whole minutes. And there was my stuck note. So I stuck in part of that, and you can sort of hear it getting towards that stuck note with different timbres going around. And then there's a fixed sound for, like, 30 seconds or so, and that stuck note is my dedication to Alvin Karim. And then I wanted to make sure that the ending was really climactic, so I picked the most intense kind of sound, that not just that it's loud or anything, because you can pretty much turn anything up loud or turn it down, you know, and you may prefer to listen to something at a low volume or a loud volume. But the sound itself, some sounds have an inherent quality to them which suggests largeness or big things happening or very energetic things, large amounts of energy in use. And so the end of the Rat's Nest has some sounds to it which are sort of what I like to think of as enormous. Even if you play them very quietly, they just have this enormous quality to them. So the piece starts in the beginning with very tiny things and ends with huge, enormous things, and runs the gamut in between.
Let's listen to it. 5.5 minutes of Rat's Nest. Folks, keep the radios tuned right in. We're not experimenting with your frequencies or messing around with the transistors. This is the composition. Chris Konigsberg, Rat's Nest. Nest, Christopher K. Konigsberg. You're all still there. Yeah.
Do not adjust your set.
Well, depending on your point of view, it goes uphill or downhill from here.
When I used to live in California, I would drive up and down the freeways a lot, and one of my favorite experiences was setting the radio in between stations. And as I would go around curves and up bumps and down bumps, different stations would pop in and out. There would be sometimes just static, but often there would be incredible, impossible segues that no human being mixing at a DJ desk could have done deliberately. So I like that sort of serendipitous thing that you find. I also appreciate things that are completely crafted consciously from the beginning also, and I hope someday to do a piece that's more like that. And perhaps the next piece that we
let's hear about you. You mentioned Mills College. Now, you know, Mills College comes up a whole lot, so we better hear about your history, how you where you started in music. You talked about you did jazz work. You talked about playing acoustic bass.
When I was 5 years old, my parents thought it would be cute for me to play the accordion. So there's a photo of me, 5 years old, sitting with an accordion on my lap. And for a couple of months, I took accordion lessons. And I guess it became kind of clear that it was sort of ungainly and awkward. And this was before the accordion revival sparked by the polka guys. They switched me to a guitar, small-sized guitar, and I started taking guitar lessons before I was 6 years old. So I was taking kind of classical lessons and pop lessons and flamenco lessons all through my early years when I was a kid. And in flamenco, you're supposed to improvise. You sort of learn basic themes, and you play them, but each time you maybe play them a little differently. You add something and you noodle around and stretch something out. So at a very young age, I was into that idea of theme and spontaneous variations on the guitar. And in high school, I kind of realized that I was never going to have the time to practice enough to really be able to master all that's necessary to be a real accomplished lead guitarist. You have so many responsibilities, and you have to be able to cover so much ground in so many different ways to really do what I would want to do right, that I realized it was just impossible. Actually, I went and saw John McLaughlin in concert, and I just said, all right, forget it.
It's been done. Yeah, you can't do
yes, exactly.
Can't do that.
So, but I realized that I could have a lot more to say with the bass. And I had a chance in high school to play bass sometimes. Actually, I got to play drums sometimes. I went to an experimental hippie freak high school, and our high school band was an acid rock band.
Where was that?
It was an experimental high school outside Philadelphia that got closed down a few years later, probably for the benefit of all concerned. But I got to play drums and play bass and play guitar. And I really grew fond of the aesthetic of playing bass, that you have sort of large notes that mean a lot. And you might play them fast sometimes, and other times you might play them really slow, but you're dealing with large shapes and big things. Mm-hmm. And that kind of appealed to me, to work on the large structure of the music. Let the lead guitar player shoot out all kinds of notes in small scale structures. I was going to work on the large scale structure, like the whole room and the architecture of the columns in the room and whatnot. And so we had an experimental improvisation band when I was in high school. It was called Chaos. It was chaos spelled with a Q. And then for my senior project in 1976, I produced and directed Dr. Squeeble's Multimedia Freak Show. So I got to sign out some tape recorders, and we had some 8mm film cameras and 35mm cameras, and we went away for 8 weeks and worked on this bizarre show. I was doing music concrete, mixing things in my basement and whatnot. And then I took more classical guitar lessons in college for credit, where you had to be proper and hold your hand in just the right way to get a good grade, and you had to mute the...
Where did you go first to college?
Carnegie Mellon University.
Okay, so that was where you were at the radio.
Yes, and I got on the radio, and as I said, for 10 years, from 1976 until 1986, I hung out at the radio station, I mean, almost every day, and I lived and breathed for WRCT. I was a total radio geek.
So by that time, you had this all in your head, and how did you get to Mills? How did that all happen? Did you make a conscious decision to become a composer of...
At around the end of my tenure as an undergraduate, where I took 6 years because I went part-time after a while, and I was also working full-time before I was finished with school, I got to take a class in computer and electronic music from Roger Dannenberg and Marilyn Taft Thomas at Carnegie Mellon. And I fell in love with that stuff so much, and I did some compositions in their electronic studio, and I had a guest appointment as the guest composer so that I could keep coming back and doing more pieces afterwards. And then I was a unpaid research fellow with the Center for Art and Technology there, again, just because I have a sort of paranoid inferiority complex, and I feel as though I need some sort of justification for being here, for, you know, working in your studio, or else they'll come and carry me away, you know, wrap me up in a straitjacket and haul me off unless I can say I've got a title, you know. So anyway, I did a series of pieces there that were called morphic resonance pieces, and then with some guys that I met at the radio station, we formed a free-form acoustic improvisation ensemble called the Morphic Resonance Trio in 1984. And I kept that ensemble going until I left Pittsburgh in 1991, 7 years later. The two original guys, one of them left town and the other one got pissed off at me and wouldn't talk to me after a while, so I had to reform it with all new people. So it went through a few more metamorphoses, so to speak, metamorphics, and it became the Morphic Resonance Electroacoustic Ensemble. It had an oboe player and a guy who played monster feedback. He had a rack of effects processors that would just feed back into itself, and he would just sit there turning knobs on this monster feedback thing. Then, in 1991, I got the opportunity finally to go to graduate school at Mills College. I had met some of the people there some years earlier. I had met Larry Polansky and David Rosenboom.
Right.
Had such a wonderful time talking to them about music and things that I was interested in, and they kept saying you should come to Mills someday. You know, a lot of people come to Mills College in the middle of their career. They take a sort of a break, a vacation for a couple of years to get this MFA degree in electronic music. And I kept saying, okay, I'll see you there someday. I'll see you there someday. You know, starting in 1985 or 86 or so, and then it was 6-7 years later when I actually got to go in 1991. Both Larry and David were gone by then, of course.
Mm-hmm, right.
But I still had a good time there, and Chris Brown was my advisor there, and Alvin Curran was a teacher there, and Willie Wynut is a wonderful percussion player who also teaches there. And they're just really fantastic people, and it was a great opportunity, and I made a lot of music. I put on a thesis concert, and then I put out the Brain CD of the music from the thesis concert. That all finished in 1993, 1994, and I've been dying to get back and do more music since then. I've just started to go back to graduate school again for a second master's degree, this time in computer science, because to really complete what I want to do, I needed both the artistic side from the MFA and the technical side from the MS degree in computer science. In fact, my master's thesis at Mill was titled The Insane and the Technical. And one of the sort of epigram quote was, "The technocrat must set the stage carefully for the madman to dance with abandon." And that's sort of my philosophy.
Yeah, yeah.
That those two have to work together.
Let's hear another piece, and then we'll come back and find out what you're doing now, and also talk a little bit about your sort of philosophical approach to things, because I've read a lot by you for various reasons. So let's hear a piece. What's good to hear?
Well, let's put on the piece called Brains. It's the title track, so to speak, of the CD. Actually, it started with a tape from 1975. Again, back in the high school when I was doing Dr. Squeeble's Multimedia Freak Show and all that, some friends and I had an amazing jam session going. There were three people playing one guitar. One guy was playing the top three strings, the other guy was playing the bottom three strings, and I was mixing on a Fender Princeton Reverb amp with the reverb and tremolo knobs and the treble and bass and the volume and everything. And we had this just incredible synergistic, huge, monstrous sludge going. I mean, something like the Rat's Nest now is the digital realization of what I was doing with my friends back then in 1975. And we were taping one of these sessions when my dad walked in. And he was in a bad, grumpy mood, I guess, and he yelled at us. And his yelling was on the tape. And ever since then, I've always wanted to do something with that voice of his. So I got the chance at Mills when I had to, I guess I had to pretty much show that I'd mastered MIDI technology and sampling, this sort of thing where you you arrange a bunch of little snippets of recordings inside this box, and then you trigger them to play back from a keyboard or something. Well, I have this instrument called a Buchla Thunder. That's a it's a MIDI controller. It's not a keyboard. It has all these different pads that you touch, and if you move your fingers on them, it sends out different kinds of signals. So I set up a sort of a playpen to play in with a carefully regimented set of the samples of my dad's original voice, each word separately and then combinations of the words, and I had them in different places where they would come out in different locations at different speeds. Maybe they would loop in different ways. And then the Thunder also had different kinds of controls on it, which would have certain kinds of programs. Sometimes if I would touch one of these pads, it would set up a whole sequence of things which I could then alter. I could massage it by moving my hands around. So I had a whole playpen of sounds to play with that was based on my dad's voice yelling at me in 1975, which is sort of, you know, the inspiration, say, for a lot of my noise making since then. And then I took that into a 24-track studio and overdubbed it again and again in stereo tracks. So I had like 12 different stereo tracks overdub, where I began to build up structures through improvisation on this playpen instrument that I had created, and then finally applied my theory of mixing technique to produce a coherent whole, and that's the piece, Brains. And then fortunately, I was fortunate enough to be able to volunteer for an experiment. After I left Mills, we went to Chicago, and I worked at the University of Chicago, and they have a brain research center in the hospital there, and I just happened to come upon an email or a Usenet news article posting where they were looking for volunteers to go into an MRI machine, a magnetic resonance imaging, because they wanted to just examine something about blood flow in and out of the brain. And they said normally people who go into the MRI thing are afraid that they might have cancer or something, and they're being diagnosed, and they can't sit still, and they have to be sedated with Valium or something just to be able to endure the process. But I went in, I had so much fun. I thought it was great. I was saying, this is just like my music, you know, all these incredible sounds swirling around my head, and I had no problem meditating. You had to lie perfectly still in something the size of a coffin for like 25 minutes with all these weird sounds going around your head. And I said to them, you know, this is really great. This is just like my music. And they gave me a printout of my brain. And I said, if I put out a CD someday, I'm going to use this as the the cover for my CD. And it really worked out because of the piece called Brains. And now I had a real picture of my brain. So
that's yours.
It's the title track, and there's my brain on the cover of the CD.
Here it is. Brains, the title track on Brains by Chris Konigsberg, whose brains are on the cover of Brains.
No more. That's it. No more.
Brains, music by Christopher K. Konigsberg.
I think that's enough for today. Maybe we can continue tomorrow, should the response be as overwhelming as it has been already.
Oh, we didn't get any take-it-off calls today.
True enough.
We will continue with our interview with Christopher K. Konigsberg next week on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar here on WGDR Plainfield.
But in the meantime, we have plenty of other music of different nature. Still difficult.
Difficult listening. We do, by the way, during the course of the next few minutes, as we're preparing to play some James Tenney, we would like to give away a copy of Brains to the second caller to the station, 802-454-7762. So to the second caller, you may have a copy of Audiophile Computer Music by Christopher K. Konigsberg, Brains, 802-454-7762.
This is a copy still in its original shrink wrap. Does this count as caller number one?
I think that counts as caller number one.
Excuse me a moment.
Sure. And in the meantime, we'll go back in time to 1961 to James Tenney's collage number one called Blue Suede. Difficult listening from the notion of creating music all sort of bundled together, put together, and sort of complexified. And so Tenney worked very, very hard at taking little bits and pieces of tape and putting them together from radio broadcasts. Difficult listening. We've heard it so many times that we really feel and sense the contour in this James Tenney. Here it is, Blue Suede, collage number one from 1961.
You
Blue Suede, a collage for tape by James Tenney.
We did have a winner, just by the by.
Oh, we did have a winner.
We did give away A Brains, or A Brain, the audio file, computer music of Christopher K. Königsberg.
Excellent.
And there will be one more opportunity next week to win yet another copy of Brains.
You're giving yours away.
Alas, yes. It has been awaiting for some momentous occasion, and I thought this would be the perfect opportunity. It is still in its original shrink wrap, and has not yet seen the light of...
Been unshrunk.
Right.
More difficult listening. And I guess we're only calling it difficult listening because it asks for a new kind of listening. And anything that's a new kind of listening is difficult. Kenny's probably not as difficult as it used to be, only because we hear sound collage 35 years later frequently. We hear sound collage in advertisements all the time. So that's not as hard. A little bit more difficult sometimes is a music without melody, without identifiable harmony, and frankly without a very clear traditional form.
Such as Amy Beach.
Such as Amy Beach. I didn't bring any.
No, but that's what makes it so difficult to play today.
Well, we have another E.
Yes?
That's Laurie.
Oh,
not Amy. Laurie Spiegel. This is a piece called Riding the Storm from her compact disc Unseen Worlds. And this is music whose real attitude, I suppose, is textural. The feel, the sensibility, the taste, as it were, of the music, rather than any kind of identifiable melodies or harmonies as we might normally think of them. So, a different kind of difficult listening. Certainly not easy listening. Not elevator music.
No,
unless you're in that kind of elevator. Here it is, Riding the Storm by Laurie Spiegel. Riding the Storm, music by Laurie Spiegel. Textural.
It brings to mind the what was the band who played, who sang that very song? It was The Doors.
The Doors.
Yes, Riding on the Storm.
Very, very rock and roll-like.
Yes, it's very similar.
Another kind of difficult listening is that which is the sonic result of, one might say, a concept gone precise.
Uh-oh. I have a very bad feeling about this. I think I know what is coming.
Yes.
What is
coming is a piece called Inner Time by Horacio Radulescu. This is Inner Time 2. And I think we have played this before, and I think this time it's incumbent to read the description. Because before we just listened to it, and I find it maddeningly beautiful, but at the same time, knowing about it can almost throw off the appreciation. I think this is one of the times where hearing the description of the compositional technique is anti-helpful.
That's what we need then. Do read.
Inner Time 2. The pitch structure is based on a scale of 42 pitches, spectral scordatura, which are the partials 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and then every odd-numbered partial up to the 83rd of a low A. The emphasis on odd-number partials neatly matches the natural timbre of the clarinet, reinforcing, as the composer puts it, the sober and poetic unity of the score. Skipping down past the description of the ensemble to the next paragraph. In both inner and outer form, Radulescu's Opus 42 is an homage to Alexander Calder. The basic material is a single registral filter, a basic shape, mobile of distinctly Calder-like appearance laid over the spectral scordatura, which is in macro form, providing the overall descent, ascent, and on a smaller scale, furnishing 137 mobiles derived from the basic one by the quasi-serial process of inversion, retrograde, and retrograde inversion, as well as contraction and expansion in space, pitch, and time. The principal formal tool at many levels is the golden section, sectio aurea, 1 to 0.618, and its rationalization in the so-called Fibonacci series, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, etc. The basic filter is itself the product of four intersecting layers of golden section proportions. These proportions also determine the work's time structure at the upper two of the four distinct levels, four layers of psychoacoustical Wahrnehmung perception, where the composer defines the macro-macro time, micro-macro time, macro-micro time, and micro-micro time. In the first instance, the golden section determines the relative lengths of the downstream long and upstream short. The turning point is a massively protracted 89-second version of the basic shape, which begins during the 34th minute, rising from the lowest spectral orbit. And I'll skip down to the end. The final is that of the sound's inner life, the fastest oral information, up to plus or minus 333 informational changes per second in spectrum or timbre.
Okay, now prove it.
Thank you.
the Armand Angster clarinet system playing Radulescu's Inner Time 2.
You were mentioning just mere moments ago about teeth, and this is this does have some teeth quality to it.
It does. You know, actually, I've listened to the entirety of this piece. I just let it go, and it's once the sort of harsh edge of it wears off, I guess it's kind of like hot food or dare I say, a good single malt scotch. It's after a little bit, it the whatever edge that was there that at first drives you away is lost. I'll just take a moment to tell the story of a composer I'd love to have on the show if we can find her, Margriet Hunderdos. I heard a piece for two E-flat clarinets some years ago by her, which consists of 20 minutes of them playing a quarter tone apart as they moved up and down various notes. It was infuriating and then wonderful. I was infuriated for quite a few hours afterwards, and then woke up the next morning seeing the dawn in a new light because of that.
It was your bed of nails, I think, that really put things into perspective.
It could have been. Well, that's pretty much the Calvos and Damian New Music Bazaar for today.
Pretty much, but not quite.
Yes, we do have one more piece, a classic work from the 1980s by Milton Babbitt. This is Correspondences for String Orchestra and Tape. A wonderful, wonderful work. I'm sorry, did I say 1980s? Sorry, 1960s.
Oh, good.
I'm a few years from my wherever. Yes, middle age.
Two.
Difficult listening of a different sort. This asking for, in Babbitt's approach, his very mathematical and calculated approach, which he disposes of when he feels like it, in the actual approach to how the music is to be heard. He composes very sensuous music with a very rigorous bass to it. So cast aside the rigor and dive into the sensuality.
Into the nails, as it were.
As it were. Until next week, until our next interview with Konigsberg, this is the Chicago Symphony under James Levine with Milton Babbitt's Correspondences for String Orchestra and Tape. Thank you.
Thank you. A production of Baltimore Media.